Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Two Crickets in a Thorn Tree, the smoothest glass of Amarula for your mind, which is, I think, what we're going to settle on as the catchphrase or something for the show. I'm half of your hosts, Mr. Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by, of course,
Gabriel Krauser. Hello, hello, hello.
The other half of your hosts, I should not neglect to say. Right, so what are we going to talk about today? Well, I think the first thing we should talk about is precisely, I think, one of the more delightful stories we've heard of in the last week, and that is something Gabriel sent to me. It's a bit of an old story, but it is the story of the Cliff Young Shuffle.
Oh, my word.
So, tell me if I'm forgetting anything, Gabriel, but this is a story of a, what is he, 60-year-old farmer?
No, hold on, Nick. No, you've got to tell the story right. Let's start with ultra-marathon runners running from Sydney to Melbourne or something absurd like that. These people run for 7 days. They run for 18 hours. They sleep for 6 hours. They run for 18 hours.
Hundreds and hundreds of kilometers, just extreme endurance running. It's like the most crazy stuff in the universe.
Yeah, like four comrades in a row, but over 7 days.
Yeah.
And it's really, I mean, people are trying really hard. And one of the big ones is from, I think, Sydney to Melbourne. And all these young bucks are there and they've been eating their protein bars and like stretching and doing all the things they're supposed to
do. They've got their professional coaches.
Yeah. And psychological assistants, and it's all lined up. And along comes Cliff, a 62-year-old Australian farmer wearing Wellington boots. And Cliff sort of looks very out of sorts in this place, but he is very skinny. And they say, "Are you here to support?" And he says, "No, I'm here to run, mate." And off they go. And Cliff is immediately stone cold last, because while everyone else is actually jogging, Cliff is doing a shuffle. He's just sort of shuffling along. And it's not a walk. It's not like a power walk, which is actually exhausting. He's definitely bouncing a little bit, but he's hardly moving his arms and his legs. It's just like a sort of bouncy, silly walk. It looks like it's something out of Monty Python. And also looks a little bit like how I ran after the second time that I broke my kneecap. Like, it is like how you'd imagine a very old man sort of who wanted to look like he was running. But couldn't be bothered. that's how Cliff looked. And he is stone cold last, and everyone runs away from him, and then they go have a nap 18 hours later, and he keeps on running, and then they all wake up and they're still ahead of him, and they run further away, but he keeps
just to be
shuffling.
Clear, he runs through the night.
Yes.
Every time.
And then the second night they go for a nap and he overtakes them while they're all sleeping. And then on the third day, you see this interview where Cliff is stopped on the side of the road for, I kid you not, a pint of milk and a change of shoes. He's finally putting on sneakers. And some interviewer is like, "Well, Cliff, you know, you haven't slept in 2.5, 3 days. Do you think you're going to have a nap anytime soon?" And Cliff says, "Well, you see now. They were all ahead of me, and they went to sleep, and now they're behind me. But if I go to sleep, I reckon they might catch up. So I'm going to get running." And they say, "But Cliff, have you got a plan about when you're going to sleep? I mean, this race, there's still 5 more days left in this race. A human being can go and, you know, when do you plan on sleeping?" And he says, "Well, the thing you've got to understand is I'm coming first, and they're catching up on me. So I better not dilly-dally. I think I'm going to shuffle along." And he's like, I mean, and I don't even want to, like, compromise his image, because he is quite a handsome man. But he has false teeth, as some people in their 60s do. And he's taken them out because he says they rattle as I shuffle. So he's got, like, he's like drinking this milk like a small child and having this interview, but But so, like, he looks a little bit like a baby, and what he sounds like, his intellect sounds like he's propounding the logic of a four-year-old, but he has the hard, steeled will of an iron man, truly.
Yeah.
And he gets back to shuffling after his thing of milk. And after a few days, I mean, it becomes like a national Australian phenomenon. And people are crowding the streets and cheering him on, and they can't believe, because he keeps not going to sleep and just carrying on running, that he's clearly in the lead. And eventually he wins and breaks the record by 2 days, which I think is possibly the most astonishing break of a record.
Right. It's almost literally the story of the tortoise and the hare, right? Like, yeah, in terms of hard work, the slow guy who just kept on going and didn't sleep or take any breaks eventually won. And he said that his experience came from spending literally days jogging around his farm, rounding up sheep in gumboots.
You know, you gotta run after the sheep. Sometimes there's a storm and some of the sheep are on the wrong side of the farm. You gotta run after them through the storm. So
this race is, I think, 960 kilometers, which is very long.
Outrageous. It is outrageous. This guy broke the record by 2 days, from like 7.5 days to 5.5 days. And then he gets onto the podium and announces, I'm giving all the money, the prize money, to all the other guys who managed to finish the race. I suppose he doesn't really need it because he's a successful sheep farmer. And then the interviewer says, so, do you think you're going to do it next year? And he says, no, I reckon not, eh? I reckon I'm never going to do that again in my life.
So a Greek guy.
A one-off wonder.
Yeah, no, he is. He's a complete
one-off
wonder.
That changed the sport forever. Sorry, yeah.
Actually beat his record, I think, a couple of years later. But basically, I think partly inspired by him.
Yeah, they changed their technique. They didn't sleep so much. They figured
out. Yeah, he taught them. It's actually an amazing story because he just taught everyone something new because he was a complete outsider from the sort of bubble. I mean, that's one of the interesting parts of the story, right? Is that, you know, there were all these guys who, you know, studied this stuff for a living and worked on this as like a career or a passion of themselves. And there was like a culture and community, and they all talked together and developed strategies, and it was highly competitive. And yet they still somehow managed to miss something, which is this the young shuffle that you talked about, where he, you know, his little sort of gumboot walking thing. Came to be adopted by other runners because he realized it expended less energy.
Yeah, both the shuffle and the sleep strategy. And I think it is like, I remember when I was a high school student, I read a study where Americans had tried to help Chinese farmers to improve their technique. And they'd been doing, I don't know, I guess they'd been doing that since Nixon opened the face to China. And a group of social scientists went around the world to look at how people were using these tractors and plows before GPS and all that, when there really was some technique to it. And they found, like, in some countries, people worked much harder and were much less efficient. China was the case study for this.
Right.
In other countries,
right,
they were half and half. I think America was a bit half and half, although with a greater standard distribution. So there were some really excellent guys and some really rubbish guys, especially on the not putting that much effort into it factor. And then there was like a village in Italy or something, like a little bit of countryside in Italy, where everyone just used that tractor the way that it had been designed and were getting much, much better results than everyone else.
Right.
But not working much harder, like working an hour a day less actually than the Chinese guys were, but they were creaming it. And the thought was, I could now put it as like an esteem economy thing. Like, within that competitive environment, if everyone's stuck inside the same paradigm, then they've got this, they've got the same recipe. So everyone's trying to make the same recipe slightly better, and they're eking out these marginal returns, but they miss out on.
Right. They're all making a vanilla cupcake or something. And then suddenly one day someone comes along and makes a chocolate cupcake, and then it blows everyone out of the water.
Oh, that's amazing. And in fact, one of the problems is the esteem market can be operating such that wayward thinkers are rejected before they get the chance to prove their point. And Cliff Young, right. like when he first enrolled and arrived, like people were clearly trying to put him off.
Yeah, I mean, it does sound silly. And I think that, you know, the smart money should always have been on the not, you know, 60-year-old farmers.
Right? Yes. No, I think that is the smart guy doesn't see that guy and be like, oh, well, I'm going to bet the farm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it is, but it is an interesting case study for, I suppose, something that we're seeing in science. And science, you know, Thomas Kuhn wrote The Theory of Scientific Revolutions somewhere in the middle of the 20th century. And he and Karl Popper were like the two famous philosophers of science, sort of really gave a name to the genre in a way that caught some public cachet. Popper much more so. And he just defined the scientific method as, you know, he described science as being that enterprise which deals in falsifiable claims. And the scientific method is to make a falsifiable claim and then try your damnedest to falsify it. And everything which has not yet been falsified is then a scientific truth. Everything else has been scientifically debunked. And the scientific truth is not the real truth because, you know, Newton's theory of how gravity works hadn't been falsified until it was 200 years later, through a few centuries later, when we stumbled into special relativity, general relativity, quantum theory, and so on.
Right.
But it's true enough that counts as scientific truth. That was Popper's idea, and I think that, together with the name, was more pop accessible. But Kuhn's thought was a little bit more sophisticated. He because it was more historical. And what he noticed was basically that a scientific revolution is something like a – it's actually the paradigm exemplar for a major disruption of the esteem market, that you have these institutions, you have these groups of people who all think in relatively similar ways, trying to eke out minor marginal improvements. And then what happens is some 62-year-old farmer comes in the wrong kind of shoes with completely outrageous ideas about how you're supposed to doing this, figure the thing out, which everyone knows are wrong. And then that guy turns out to explain not only the anomalies that the first guys kept stumbling up against, but also how to figure out a whole bunch of things that we didn't even know we did.
Right. So people don't know he's wrong. They just assume he's wrong.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Yeah.
Because no one's actually bothered to try his way before and find out that actually is, you know, rubbish.
Yeah. And when he gets up and espouses his theory, he is readily shouted down.
Right.
And Kuhn traces this this sort of pattern of people having a consensus, and it really is like fashion. It's like sort of everyone dresses this way and then someone dresses in a funny different way. Mm-hmm. And most people are like, oh my word, what are they doing? But then there's a bit of a fight. And then, I mean, one of the things Kuhn sadly had to point out now and then is there's some holdouts for the old theory that are so committed to it that the only way to really deal with them is just wait for them to die. And so the full acceptance of some parts of, for example, getting over phlogiston. Phlogiston theory is a nice example because it's something that everyone now considers to be crazy. Phlogiston was that element which had a negative weight, which was supposed to be flame. And this sort of has an ancient legacy. You know, people thought that key elements of the universe are sort of water and flame, yeah. Earth and air.
It goes back to the ancient Greeks. They believed the whole world was made of four elements.
And not just them. But so even as people started not exactly developing an atomic theory, but developing something that was sometimes called alchemy and sometimes called chemistry, which was the thought that you can really change things into other things because they've got base level building blocks that are microscopic that you can't see with the naked eye. so that you start noticing that clay and cup really are just different forms of the same thing, although their properties are quite right. different in terms of shininess and plasticity and so on. So like, well, what about flame? And they thought, well, no, there's a special flame is still a special element. That's one of the basic building blocks. And they started wondering about the conservation of mass long time deep in the Renaissance. And they're like, well, you know, it does seem plausible that, you know, you shouldn't be able to matter shouldn't be able to appear or disappear. There should be something like a conservation of mass. But they also noticed that if you weigh a lot of wood or a candle or whatever, and then you set it on fire, then it comes out lighter at the end of the fire burning. And they said, well, that must mean that the flame has a negative weight. So it is this negative weighted entity. And that theory held on for a long time. And people who doubted it were castigated and renounced and so on. And then eventually the guys with a new theory did a whole bunch of other experiments which sort of supported their theory. But there was a contest. I mean, the data to some level, the fact to some level, to some degree, underdetermined the data. In other words, two different theories can explain some of the same phenomenon. And both theories have some anomalies. So neither theory is perfect. And so then people do a lot of like, well, you know, I know you are, but what am I? This sort of like silly game. And that is science. I mean, that is a lot of science. I know my theory's got a problem, but yours is bigger. And then you sort of get into some philosophical argument about what is the most important desiderator for a good scientific theory. Our theory is more elegant, they would say. So yes, we've both got anomalies, but yours lacks elegance. And then how do you really go forward from that? And then you just, and then some of them die, and then the mainstream or more of the youth take up the better idea. Then it goes forward. So it's a very sociological, very irritating and accidental thing. And I think part of the reason that Kuhn was alive to it was because science had gone there had been mainstream race scientists that really were not following the facts. But you could see how the whole political institution rewarded them, and someone who was trying to push against them would get punished. Also in the Soviet Union, very strange ideas about evolution and sort of basically the science around agriculture and sociology and, you know, science insofar as economics is a science. Those debates seemed very – it seemed very clear that it mattered which kind of institutions you were in in terms of what was going to be accepted and what was not going to be accepted. Anyway, okay, so we've gone from an Australian runner to
– follow the party line, comrade.
Exactly. A brief outline on the old philosophy of science and how you must never let a woke person or something like that monopolize the true fact that science as an ideal, as in, you know, this system that allows us to tap into facts beyond superstition that are curious and useful, is different to science as an institution, which is just run by monkeys like you and me that have barely crawled out of the tree and have all kinds of jealousies and marital intrigues and political forces and all kinds of things can get in the way of or can create a gap between the ideal.
And let us not forget that great fella of men and women, of destroyer of careers, ruiner of lives, Pride, which... Is the thing that undoes so many, you know, all great stories have at some point, all great tragedies have someone being proud at some point, and then always precedes the fall.
And I think
and science is very much suffers from that sometimes.
So I think the proud man of the day, of the era, might be one of them. How do I say his Nick? How do I say his name, Nick? Peter Duzak.
I think that's right. Hold on, I've just lost it all of a sudden. Peter Duzak. Yeah, I think that's right.
Duzak.
President of the Eco Health Alliance of New York.
So this man, listeners to this podcast will hopefully remember the name Niall Ferguson.
Yes.
Who was he's a British.
It doesn't help that Niall Ferguson and Neil Ferguson are both famous British people.
Yes. The one, a grand historian at the Hoover Institute, And the other, what is it, University College of London or something, but he Ferguson wrote the model which first determined that without lockdown laws around the world for many months or years, 50 million people.
It was going to be a tidal wave of death unmatched for decades.
50 to 100 million. Yeah, an apocalypse. Okay. And the really bad mistake that he made was that he modeled that if the government doesn't enforce a lockdown, people aren't voluntarily going to change it.
Right. He treated people like chess pieces whom the government is the only thing with the power to move them.
Yeah.
Sort of thing.
Well put. So anyway, we're not going to get back into lockdown debate. I thought a little bit of it was good that South Africa went pretty crazy. And partly because of arguments coming from Ferguson directly and from acolytes, other scientists who were working according to the same convention that humans can't make voluntary action absent government intervention. But Peter Duzak, and I think Ferguson's name is going to stand out in the history. I think in 100 years' time, people studying
– well, especially because he went to see his mistress or something after violating the lockdown rules he had recommended.
Yeah.
That was what did in for his career, right?
Yeah.
Oof, as the kids say.
Yeah. No, that was a terrible embarrassment. But so Peter Duzak is the name behind another idea. So the one idea was absent lockdown, no one's going to change their behavior. No one's ever going to put a mask unless you make a law for it and so on. Which eventually becomes true if you start out with laws, then you create these perverse incentives and people riot against it and it all gets very silly. Anyway, so there's a name behind one of the ideas, which has defined the last year of all of our lives. Peter Duzak is another name because he is the guy basically who establishes the scientific convention according to which it is out of the question that SARS-CoV-2 was produced in a lab,
right,
and then accidentally escaped
to the wider world
as the smallpox escaped from British labs in the 60s and killed people, as terrible viruses have escaped from laboratories in America and Europe and everywhere else that has such sophisticated labs on a semi-regular basis for the last 50 years. So
right, it's
happened before, but he said it couldn't have happened this time.
Yeah, this is completely silly. This is obviously exactly like SARS-1, which came, I think, specifically from someone eating a civet or something in China. And that any suggestion otherwise was conspiracy mongering, lunacy, and crackpottery.
So, Nick, should we trust Peter on the face of it?
Well, it turns out maybe not so much, because some journalists have found that his organization funded a very specific project in China, as it turns out. And this project was based at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And this project was attempting to find out how a future version of SARS, if it evolved in the wild, what one would need to look out for to see if it was going to be a big danger to people. And so they gave funding for this project to create a super version of SARS that would be as infectious as possible. So then that could be the sort of model to look at for producing vaccines and stuff against any potential future SARS virus. That was the idea of the research.
In fact, not just one. In December 2019, he was bragging about, dozens or hundreds of new basic coronaviruses, which is the kind of virus we're dealing with in the plague. That had been developed. And this is called gain of function research.
Yes.
And the idea here is that you evolve a virus in a petri dish. One way of going about it basically is you just get this virus, you put it in a test tube, in a little petri dish, and you give it the kinds of foods that it needs, and you sort of challenge it in certain ways, and basically get a lot of life cycles going through for the virus, and then you take the best bits and you put it in a new petri dish and repeat the process. So you're always taking the cream of the cream to evolve them in particular directions. That's one thing to do. And another thing to do is to splice them. So you take a bit of this virus and a bit of that virus and you cut them together. And, you know, it's not quite 3D printing, but it's a sort of bizarrely precise process by which
right, you can... It's cool. It's the cool kind of gene editing we can do these days.
Exactly. So you better do a bit of gene editing to create a virus, and then you're like, okay, this is not going to be perfect, so let's put it in a culture where it'll survive and replicate, and then the evolutionary process will help it to get better, and then you put it in another culture which is a little bit tougher so that the weaker versions die and even better versions survive. Then you take that and put it in an even tougher culture, and then you get like the super virus that you've been looking for. And depending on what you started right. with from your splicing exercise, or depending on how you serialize it in the various cultures, you can sort of aim for particular targets of what you're trying to get out of this virus. And gain of function research is about trying to get the virus to be the best, most deadliest, terrible thing for human beings that it could be. Because once you have that, you can theoretically come up with a vaccine. It's going to take
You can build all sorts of weapons to destroy it. You can find its weaknesses. So it's kind of like a little bit like wargaming, right? Where you have someone pretend to be the enemy and say, how do we invade our own country? Except, you know, you make the virus. You basically make the bomb that would wipe out your country.
Yes.
So obviously there are some benefits to this, but there's also quite a lot of criticism because people say, well, guys, this research is all good and all, but isn't there a risk that you could accidentally create a super virus and then mistakenly release it to the world? As we know, sometimes viruses that are being studied in labs get out, as you mentioned before, with things like smallpox. And I think there have been several. I think even there may have been a case with Ebola that was similar or something like that as well. That I remember reading about, which is, you know, those have never caused a global pandemic, but it's always been, you know, a bit of a disaster. Sometimes some people have died.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a bit of a worry. And I'm kind of reluctant to wade very deep into the debate about whether there should be gain of function research or not. I'm inclined to think that there should be gain of function research, and that it should be done very carefully and under a lot of scrutiny, because my sense is that when you deliberately try and ban a kind of research, it doesn't go away. It just gets done by less responsible, shady actors.
So is perhaps the fact that there's this controversy around this research why an American group was assigned to fund this in China?
So that is part of the problem, right? So the States was the Wuhan – look, one reason we know that the Wuhan laboratory was doing research on gain-of-function research on beta coronaviruses, in particular those similar to SARS-CoV-1, is that they got funding from the American federal government at arm's length. Right. But in order to get that funding, there had to be public record – explanations of what the money's for.
Right.
So we're not just going on Peter Duzak's sort of media comments in December 2019 bragging how well they'd done at breeding a super coronavirus. We're also going on, well, before that, before they started the research, they said, here's what we want to do. We want to breed a lot of coronavirus. Now, there's some sense, it does seem to me that this could have taken place in the U.S., but that the U.S. had started to worry about gain of function research under the Obama administration, and so found it more convenient to outsource this research. I'm not entirely sure how far that argument goes. For example, I listened to a sort of five-hour podcast with Sam Harris, and a sort of science fiction writer converted into a pretty serious biology journalist who's been thinking about gain of function research since before SARS-CoV-2, since before the plague. And his argument is basically that we should allow it, and that genetic printers are going to be in high schools and universities in 20 or 30 years. It's going to be as easy to print an Ebola virus as it is to print a gun. And it really is very easy to print a gun.
It's already possible. Yeah.
So, you know, terrorists, if you spread that capacity over anyone in society with $1,000, the odds of some maniac, lone wolf, getting $1,000, getting a genetic printer, downloading small pox.
And so to preempt it, you need to adopt the technology so you can find out what the most dangerous things out there could possibly be, right? That's the idea.
Exactly. And he spoke to some reduction in the gain of function research in America, definitely cuts, but it didn't sound like they made it all go away.
Well, look, they certainly were doing this in part in China because China is where most of the research on coronaviruses in particular takes place, because they were the center of the SARS outbreak and they were quite traumatized by it. And so there's been a lot of research in China to try and work out, you know, is there another coronavirus that's going to come out like SARS that could be a big problem? The provincial governors in China can get punished if it's found that there's been an outbreak of a undiscovered flu or something in their territory.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of government pressure as well, which is also possibly, by the way, why it took so long for the true magnitude of the problem with COVID to come out. It took a while to come out because, you know, the local officials were like, no, we need to cover this up because otherwise we'll get in trouble.
We'll be in the boo-boo.
Law of unintended consequences, very much so.
So at two levels. Okay. So good reason not to trust Peter Duziak is that he organizes this group of scientists, not many, to write in The Lancet in February 2020 that there's no ways this thing could have been concocted in a lab.
Right.
It must have come from a nature, from a bat or a pangolin or something. And he doesn't declare his conflict of interest. He has a clear conflict of interest. If it has come from a lab, in particular a lab that he is closely connected to, it's going to be embarrassing to him. It's going to be make his career difficult. Maybe there'd be some culpability. I doubt there'd be legal culpability. But there would be esteem culpability, and that would be really bad for his career.
Yeah, this is the kind of stain that you don't wash off, I don't think, so easily.
No, never, never, never. Yeah. So he didn't declare that conflict of interest. And then there's another sort of paper that comes. Also, it was very soon at the time. In February, you know, one key idea in science, going back to Karl Popper, is, well, let's be careful about epistemic humility. Let's claim as fact that's what we can really support. But let's also, you know, make one social fact very clear. This is what we don't know. And in February 2020, we just didn't know one way or another. And I don't think we know now either. But
yeah. So let's be clear
for sure that it's not a lab thing. Is a bit
That's exactly, I think, the point I just wanted to make, is that we're not necessarily saying that COVID definitely came from this particular research project in this lab in Wuhan, and that's how it got out into the world, and, you know, this is all their fault, basically. We're not saying that, although we're saying it's possible.
That is a fact. It is possible. Yes. So
it's possible, and also not just possible, but probable enough to take very seriously.
Right. And I think one of the key things to note here is that, I mean, I have spoken to, at this stage, 6 top flight epidemiologists or virologists from South Africa, Europe, and America over since, I would say, December last year, who have all said to me, you can never put my name to this, but I strongly suspect, I think there's a high probability that this thing was cooked up in a lab and accidentally broke out.
Yeah.
But never put my name to it. And I think what's prompting us to speak about this here is that some prominent American scientists do seem to now be willing to put their head above the parapet. They do seem to be willing to arrive like the 60-year-old farmer and say, guys, you've all been thinking about this thing in one way, but maybe we can get to the truth much quicker, as it were, by thinking in another way. And we know that when we arrive, you're going to laugh at our Wellington boots and our shuffle and our weird ways of going about things, and you're going to say we're terrible.
And our tinfoil hats in this case as well.
yeah, children mustn't listen to us because they might get the wrong idea, and they might also shuffle and not sleep for 5 days when they do long distance marathons. So, you know, turn off the cameras when these guys come along. But it's just noteworthy that that it's no longer just good scientists giving anonymous notes to journalists. Some are now standing up for it. But I'm not so interested in the names. I'm more interested in the reasons for why. And that's what I'd like to get into. But go ahead, Nick.
Okay, yeah. No, I just wanted to say that a lot of the story we've been telling, I think, I mean, at least that I've been telling, Gabriel's got a lot more direct experience, as he says, because he was talking to all these virologists and stuff. But most of my knowledge on this comes from an article by a guy called Nicholas Wade, who's a science writer, and he's worked for various big publications over the years. And he
was at the New York Times for decades. Yeah.
Right. So he lays out the case of how the esteem market trap basically happened, and the sort of esteem blanket was put over any attempts to find alternative theories of the origins of COVID that weren't related to natural evolution, right?
Yeah.
So did that blanket get placed on things? Well, I mean,
so Dr. Dzhak, Peter Dzhak, he started off, and he's got basically two arguments for why this thing couldn't be made in a lab.
Right.
And the one argument is, if you look at how the spike protein works on a SARS-CoV-2 virus, and so you look at it in a test tube, okay? And then on the other hand, you go to your computer and you say, how, computer, would you design a perfect spike protein to latch onto ACE2 receptors in people's lungs and cells so that a virus could get in there? And he sees a serious discrepancy.
Yeah.
So his thought is, if someone was going to design this in a lab, they would design the perfect one. The perfect computer.
Right, it would be much stronger than this one, basically.
And that's not what this is. So this can't be it.
Right.
And that argument is, so he kind of puts that argument in two ways. One's about the ACE2 receptor, and the other one's about another aspect of the virus. But basically, where both arguments fall short, besides sort of lacking in imagination, is, you know, that someone might go about designing the virus in a different way, is lacking a practical grip, which he clearly has, but in his paper, lacking a practical grip on how the actual development of gain-of-function viruses works. So gain-of-function viruses don't work like this. It's not like you say to the computer, you know, what would the ideal spike protein be? And then you print that whole thing out.
Right.
Printing out, if I've got this right from the Sam Harris podcast, I don't think we've ever printed out an entire virus. I think we've come close, but it's much more normal to print out a section, right? Rather than the whole thing.
And bits and pieces, and then letting it grow itself.
Yeah, bits and pieces, and then you splice them together. And then you put it in the culture that's the most likely to keep it going. And then you do that serial thing of like taking the what survived in the one culture and then transplanting it to the next culture. So right, you let evolution do a lot of the work. Most gain of function research.
It's much more like a garden or a greenhouse rather than a machine, than like building a motorcycle or something, which is obviously what we should expect, because it is, you know, it is like a growing organism, right?
So correct. Yes. So in 30 years' time, maybe you'll be able to print out an Ebola virus from a machine. But right now, it's just like gardening. You cut off this plant and you put a little growth hormone on the stem of the branch, and you stick it onto another thing. And my mom's done this in the garden. I've helped her. And then you can have a tree that's sort of growing out another kind of tree from the side. That's the kind of model that gain of function research really works on. So that's debunking a little bit of the initial story. But the problem is that when the initial story came out, journalists didn't challenge it. I think in large part because they didn't understand it, but also in large part because people were so terrified.
Yeah, I mean, we've spent like, what, 10 minutes now just trying to explain precisely this how this stuff plays out. It's not easy to put, you know, you're a journalist, you're looking for stories, it's a hot new thing. There's all this information just coming out right now, and everyone wants to know something about COVID. And so a big journal publishes a letter, what was it? Was it a letter or an op-ed, something like that, that says, this is silly, and so you say, well, these people know better than me, so I'm going to just report that, which is a reasonable stance to take.
Again, like the betting man at the Australian race, you're gonna the smart bet is to bet on the dudes wearing sneakers and who've done this before.
Because 9 times out of 10, they're probably going to be right.
That's exactly it. Okay, so less sympathy for the scientists who stay quiet about this, because I do think it's their job to put aside, just as I think Peter Daszak should have declared his conflict of interest and exposed himself to the potential shame of, I mean, if he declared that conflict of interest, immediately a lot of publications would have said, look, by the way, it's not like this was a hard thing to figure out. Some publications did immediately denounce him, but they were mostly like very fringe. Mainstream publications would have denounced him as a potential human agent who was part of the course, okay, right, of this terrible thing. And then there would have been good talking heads doing what I'm about to do, which is to say, you know, even if you are causally connected to a terrible thing, if you weren't doing it deliberately, our sense of culpability should be very different. If you put in all the best measures and there was just bad luck, then we really actually should try and stop people from blaming that person too aggressively at all. I mean, there is just such a thing as bad luck. And just also, like, we shouldn't throw him out of him as a baby out of the bathwater. We also shouldn't necessarily throw gain of function out. We should rather look at better ways of thinking about gain of function research. One of the stories that Nicholas Wade in particular cases that he makes is that there are different sort of security levels at these laboratories. The highest is 4, but that one of the problems is, and he says that this happened at the Wuhan lab, that there's evidence that this happened at the Wuhan, that is sort of on public record, that at the Wuhan lab, coronaviruses that were less deadly and infectious than MERS and SARS were studied at level 2. But when you're doing the gain of function research, the whole point is that you turn a level 2 virus into a level 4 virus.
Right.
And
right.
So in a sense, all gain of function research that is about producing more infectious and deadly viruses, that should all really be level 4, because whatever you're starting out with, you can start out with a rose, but you're getting, like, I don't know, poison ivy or
exactly,
something terrible out of it. Anyway, so that's the kind of proposal that I'd like to make, and it's the kind of one that I think people would have been, that kind of thing would be common knowledge by now. Everyone would have a view on that debate by now if it had really started in February last year. But instead, what happened is there was like, look, you've got to believe that is a crazy conspiracy theory to think that this was made in a lab. Along with the mainstream. And so that puts a blanket down on people thinking about the real reasons virologically to consider this virus to be something that came out of a laboratory.
Helped along by a lab.
And there are a few points, but the main point is just this. And this is a little bit complicated to explain, but bear with me for 3 minutes as I do my damnedest. So when this virus, this SARS-CoV-2, like any coronavirus, when it approaches your cell, it's got its little doorknob sticking out, the spike proteins, and let's put it like this. On the end of it is part of the spike protein whose job it is to figure out, when have I come into contact with the kind of thing that I'd like to break into?
Right.
So it's like the whiskers or something. And it's sort of, okay, here we are. This is the place we want to go. But the thing that's detecting this is where we want to break into is not the same as the thing that then has the ability to break into the cell. So the detector has to kind of snap off the edge, and then the knife that was hidden inside the glove can latch on and open up the cell, and then the virus gets in and injects its RNA or DNA. Some viruses have DNA and starts reproducing itself. Now, there's a fancy. There are various ways that can be that this can be done. That the viruses spike at the edge can break off, and in all beta coronaviruses, which is the broad family within which SARS and MERS and SARS-CoV-2 and all of these things come from, there's one way that none of them use, and that is called a furin cleavage site.
Right.
And what a furin cleavage site is like just the very special and very useful way to make this break between, as it were, the detector on the outside and the sort of penetrator, really latcher, that comes within it.
So hang on, Gabriel. You said that all coronaviruses in the beta group don't use the furon cleaver cleavage
with
site.
With the exception of one called SARS.
Which one is that? Ha! Really makes you wonder.
So this is a problem for people who think it came out of bats or anything, because there's nothing in bats that acts like SARS-CoV-2 in this very important way.
The furon cleaver isn't very good for getting into bat cells.
It's also rubbish for getting into bats.
Yeah, so the human cells are the cells that it's really good at getting into. So
the human specificity thing is even more complicated. And this was a lesson that I got from a virologist at the start of the year. But basically, you know, when you think of DNA, I think most people think of like a couple of letters.
I think most people think of a twisting helixes going
helix, and on the end of both sides of the strand is like a letter. It's like A connects with G and so on and so forth. And there are only four letters. So each strand is holding two letters. And sometimes people think a gene is just sort of one of those letters. Turns out what a gene is something somewhat up for philosophical debate. And that's where Richard Dawkins was actually really great, is he sort of helped make sense of that. But the point I'm trying to get is, how's a good way to think about this? So different letters can make up, as it were, different words, and then different words can make up different sentences. So if we go from, and but you can have five letters making a word and five different letters making the same word. So there's a thing called synonymy, right? So I'm struggling to think out loud of two words that sound and are spelled completely differently but that mean the same thing.
Neither can I think of that, but I think we get it.
But you know what I mean. Like couch and chaise lounge are more or less the same thing. Car and automobile are just exactly the same thing.
Right.
But they look and sound very different. And then you can have different words making the same sentence. So like, I'm going to go over there. The boy hit the dog, or the dog was hit by the boy. Okay, some of the words are the same, but the order's changed. One of the words is a completely different word, was hit by, rather than hit. The was has been added in there. You can have sentences that have different words, but that nevertheless remain synonymous. And that's most obvious if you've got words that are synonymous, like, you know, automobile and car.
Right.
Now, this is all to say that in a really significant bit of genetic information, that really significant bit of genetic information can be made up in different combinations. There's different ways to get to the same basic idea within that bit of genetic information. And computer coders will understand this. You know, to get a computer program to do, like, get the light flashing once every second in the top left corner of the screen, you can kind of go about that in different ways, even within the same coding language.
Yeah, you can make 100 nested if statements forever, but that's not going to work so well, but you can do it that way.
You can do that, or you can, you know, have a separate thing and you call it up, call up if, yeah. Okay. So why this matters is that there are specific signatures that you can pick up when you go below the level of sentence into the level of words and letters, where you can see how even for the same sentences, in some species, you tend to find these letters and words, and in other species, you find these letters and words. So different species have, as it were, different styles, even if they're writing the same sentence. And same sentence in the sense that if you were to swap out the one sentence for the other, if you were to splice it, cut it out, this sentence with these words and letters, and put in a different sentence with different words and letters, but where it would still work because those sentences mean the same thing, like right. changing the word automobile for car. But it's just for some species, viruses that target certain species are inclined to use words like car. And in attacking other species, they're inclined to use words like automobile. Now, as it turns out, in the differences between bats and pangolins and humans, there's a very clear difference in this kind of affinity for a particular phrase or style of reaching a sentence. And guess where the most clear and uncanny signature is of human phraseology in this virus. In all of the places of the virus, where does it seem to be the most uncannily human and very unbat-like?
I don't know. You tell me.
At the furin cleavage site.
Ah.
So the right, furin cleavage site exists in SARS-CoV-2, but no other coronavirus that we know of, beta coronavirus. And at this very particular site, the way that that particular site is constituted bears all of the signatures of a virus that's been hanging out with humans
for a
very, very long time.
So there is a natural explanation for how this happened rather than the lab design theory, which is that, you know, this virus was circulating undetected for quite a long time amongst people in China. Maybe it even didn't come from Wuhan. Maybe it came from somewhere else. And then suddenly they only discovered it at some point, or maybe a variant emerged that was more deadly or something like that. And then they were like, oh my goodness, there's this virus here. We just thought it was a cold, but actually it's much worse. And then suddenly that new version spread to the whole world.
There is that theory. Part of the problem with that theory is, as you say, China and its surrounding areas have been researching beta coronaviruses quite seriously for quite a while. And there's no dispositive evidence to show that that theory is true, although there are a lot of blood samples of a lot of Chinese people that got hella sick and died.
Yeah.
And those that didn't. So, you know, there's another theory which Nicholas Wade brings up, which is that if it did come from bats or something, it might come from people researching bats in the guano caves, 1,500 kilometers or whatever it is from Wuhan, and then gone back to the Wuhan laboratory because it's those guys who are the most likely to both spend so much time with the bats that you get the kind of opportunity for these one in a billion, one in a gazillion mutations.
Right.
And I mean, then to come back and have the launch point for the virus be in Wuhan rather than very far away, where it would seem more naturally to come. So there are these possibilities.
There are also other sort of weird things. Like, I think there've been some claims that there's a sort of thing that connects all of the hospitals where they detect the first COVID cases, which is that they all run on the same subway line as the Wuhan Institute of Virology. I'm less sure of that one, but there are some claims that that's sort of an early geographical pattern of the virus's spread. So
one of the major reasons to consider that the virus might have come from a lab is the pattern of mutation.
Yeah.
So far everything's fitting with what we discussed the last time we talked about SARS-CoV-2, pretty close to the start of the year, was that studies of beta coronaviruses, particularly from the UK for the last 5 decades, provide the strong suggestion that if a beta coronavirus does get into the wild, then 8 months is around the time that you should start expecting it to evolve some escape mutations. That means evolve the capacity to escape some of the immunodefense that people get from having gotten the virus and then recovering.
Right.
The other kind of mutation is a host mutation where it's just getting better at eating the kind of food that you are, so to speak. And what you would expect, and so this Indian strain seems, you know, it's fitting very much like, okay, the thing comes out, and the South African strain looks like it comes out 8 months later. The Indian strain looks like it very much comes out 8 months later than that. And those are the cardinal ones that I'm talking about because they bear the cardinal hallmarks of real escape rather than the UK strain, which just got slightly better at eating the kind of food that you have. And notwithstanding the fact that the Brazil strain is a lot like the South Africa strain, I'm just using the most obvious names for these things. But the point that I'm trying to get to is that while that pattern seems to have fit with at least the research that I've read from the 90s dating back, so long before this was in any way a politicized thing, what doesn't fit so well is the pattern of host mutation. Zoonotic viral infection is much more usually what one expects. If you have a virus crossing from one species to another, is that it's got a steep learning curve, is that it's mutating quite regularly in non-synonymous ways. That means ways that have meaningful differences, not just the swapping out automobile for car, really meaningful differences.
Yeah.
And meaningful differences that make it better at dealing with the host, at eating the kind of food that the host is and using the host's mechanisms to spread and so on and so forth. And it is like climbing a mountain. To reach the fitness peak would be like its most efficient place. If it crosses species, you'd expect it to sort of be at the bottom of like a diagonal mountain, and it's sort of climbing kind of day by day, getting a little bit better, a little bit better.
Yeah.
Rather than like with these host mutations where it's sort of sitting flatline, and then after a while you see there's a leap where some particular combination of changes has finally been landed on that gives it a bit of a step up. And so
leaves a bit of a trail, doesn't it? Yeah.
It leaves a trail, and genomic sequencing has been taking place from day one, and we really don't see much of that trail. The surprising thing was that something like the British strain took so long to come about, and that it had very much this hallmark of like the step up rather than a slow incremental sort of it arrived in quite a stable way, which again fits with the thought that it's been cultured. And Dr. Peter Dzak was very proud of how well they'd managed to infect humanized mice.
To be like human beings.
Yeah. So that's the kind of thing that you'd expect from something like that. Not something that you'd expect so much from natural evolution. Again, not to say that it can't happen. Not to say
It looked like a tree in a plantation rather than a tree in a forest. You can get a tall, straight tree in a forest. It's just not as common.
Yeah.
And it's more likely to find it in a plantation.
You can have 10 tall, straight trees in a row. In a forest, says if you see 10 tall straight trees in a row, it's not your first assumption that this is an act of nature. So, are we arguing that you should, pick up your pitchfork and go shout at the New World Order? Not at all.
But right, I think say something on that point in particular, actually.
Yeah.
Is I think one of the reasons why there was also a move to kind of distance respectable opinion away from this theory is that there was a fear that people would hear this kind of complicated story that involved some human error and then spin it way into, you know, crazy conspiracy theory and say, ah, you see, this is the truth. We told you the New World Order was right behind you. And so there was an assumption, I think, built into opinion shapers that the people are too dumb to get the distinctions and the subtleties here. And instead, we need to just kind of stay away from anything that sounds like a conspiracy theory in discussing, because, you know, who knows where that might lead. What do you think? I think that's a very much a view that many people in the media have taken since fake news became a buzzword.
Yeah, I think that is right. And I think it's a little bit, again, like the Ferguson mistake of treating, you know, if you treat human being like ants, who are only going to do things when the government forces them to, it turns out, as far as I can tell from my experience in South Africa, they become more like ants. People right. were much more responsible and volitionally responsible when it was still in their control. And then after like endless lockdown and whatever, I just, especially in the rural areas at times, I'm just seeing a lot of like people who, as a point of pride, insist on handshaking every stranger that they meet. And, you know, it doesn't make part of my work irritating. When I go out on these countryside jaunts, I kind of have to self-isolate and get tested before I can hang out with a lot of people I know who are over 60. But I, whatever, it's my job. So, but it is, I do think that's a product of the way that people have been treated. And if you treat people like stupid children who can't handle the truth, then it turns out a lot of people start acting that way. And the best way to inflame the most radical kind of conspiracy theorists is to cover a fact up or to cover a set of facts which undermine your own narrative.
Because then everyone can legitimately ask the question at that point, how deep does this go?
Yeah.
Or how much, if this is what we know publicly, how much are they not telling us?
Exactly. And I think it's I think you're spot on right to say that the theory was people will take this too far if you give any legitimacy to it, and if anything, that's made things worse. So what is there to take away from this? I mean, one of the sad things to take away from this is that it does radically undermine, as if it weren't enough already, the WHO's independence. Because right. the WHO went and did its independent investigation in February of this year and found once again that there's no chance of a lab leak, nothing to see here.
Our friend Peter was also, I believe, on that a part of that group, actually.
He was part of the investigating committee. Peter Duzak right. was investigating his own thing after having already said a year earlier that there's no chance that there could have been a lab leak. So on that basis alone, he'd sort of exposed so when a conflict later, of interest.
So and when the WHO team said, we've got everything on the table and we're considering every possibility, I mean, well, one of your senior members actually doesn't agree with that stance.
Yeah. And he's got a vested interest in things coming out. So Peter right. Dzak's a problem, but he's just one person. I think the other thing that I take away from this is Niall Ferguson, the Scot historian who is at Stanford University and the Hoover Institute, and really is quite a brilliant fellow. He has this phrase which he coined, and it gained some popularity, and we even discussed it before. And then, it sort of fell out of fashion a little bit, but maybe it'll come back. Chimerica. His thought, two things he liked to push. One is Cold War II, that we've already entered a new kind of Cold War. And I think he was pushing this before Donald Trump became president. I think after Donald Trump's time, I think most people agree that there are very serious geopolitical tensions between America.
Especially China. Now when you see continuity between Trump and Biden and a lot of their China policy, actually.
Yeah.
That it is now definitely more hostile to China, and China's more hostile to the US. The relationship is completely soured from both ends.
It's not just partisan, and it's not just America. It's many, many countries. So Cold War II, but Cold War II, it's like, what is Cold War II? What is it different to? It's different to Chimerica. And Chimerica is basically the model that emerges out of 78, but especially into the 90s, 2000s, and 2010s, where China's labor market, which had been artificially repressed under Mao, opens up, and Americans with a lot of money put their factories in China, where they get cheaper labor, make a lot of stuff, and then sell it back to America.
And also don't have to follow as many sort of health and safety regulations and all that kind of stuff, because in China, you know, a building, I think there was a senior Chinese government member who said a building only has to last 20 years, for example.
There's all kinds
it's a very different environment.
Yeah. And part of if you really want to get into Ferguson's, I'm getting the Neil and the Nile confused, so I'm just saying Scott Ferguson's, the Scottish historian Ferguson's way of thinking about Chimerica, you really have to think about financial markets, about bond markets, about currencies. Look, I think he's right. I think it's pretty irrefutable that the way that finance and labor and capital and fiscal sort of financial sovereignty, finance as in banking and fiscal sovereignty as in reserve banks or base currencies, the ways that those have related have been really good for pulling 800, have been an integral part of how 800 million Chinese were pulled out of poverty or pulled themselves out of poverty in the last 30 years. Really good news story. And how Americans could get such cheap iPhones and so on. There's a lot going on there. But this seems to be such a Chimerica example in its darkest tones, right? Because there is really, really good stuff to it. And the ultimate project was that by opening up markets to China and investing directly into China, despite some funny rules, once Deng Xiaoping had basically privatized almost all of the private house of all of the housing and real estate markets and half of the, let's say, stock markets, it seemed to be capitalist enough or free market enough that if you just get in and help them out, we'll go all the way together and China will become a sort of liberal free market democracy. That was the sort of aspiration. A big part of the problem was this sort of the shady side of it. And the thought that this gain of function research starts in America, that the Americans get a little bit NIMBY about it, not in my backyard. They get a little bit iffy about some of it. So they outsource it, send it to a place where the standards aren't as good. I mean, there were complaints coming out of the Wuhan Institute.
This is one of the things that made me take this theory quite seriously from the first time I heard it, was that I read about some Canadian researchers who were doing shared research with a Chinese institute. I'm not sure if it was the Wuhan one. I think it was a different one. And they said, guys, can you send us some samples of these particular dangerous diseases? And the Chinese said, sure. And when they arrived, they were like not sealed properly and almost, you know, a serious threat to the safety of the people who had handled them.
At the Wuhan Institute, before the plague, there was a report filed saying, look, this is a level 4 lab. This is supposed to be the most secure lab in the world. But they don't have enough special person, you know, high level personnel to really administer it.
Right.
So, and on top of that, the gain of function research wasn't being done in the level 4 way. It is being done in the level 2 way, which means it's even easier for it to get out.
Because the level 4 way is really annoying. You have to put on like a big suit and everything is slow. And it's very annoying. Yeah.
So it does seem like this Chimerica thing of kind of outsourcing. You've got the good fancy idea. You outsource the labor to a place where it's a bit cheaper, where the rules are a bit easier to bend for the sake of some kind of efficiency. And then there's a bit of an accident, and the interesting thing is that it's not in either – that for a while, Washington was criticizing Beijing and saying, China virus, China virus. And look, I think it's perfectly reasonable to call it the Chinese virus in the same way that it's perfectly reasonable to call it the Spanish flu. I mean, even if it didn't come from Spain, came from Texas, whatever, calling it the Spanish flu is an homage to the fact that they had the best free press at the time. So it was the first place that it was really reported on. And for everyone else who's not that into it, It's just the same name that everyone else uses. Language works by convention like that. And SARS-CoV-2 is a little bit hard to remember, but hey, we've got SARS-CoV-2, so let's rather call it SARS-CoV-2. I'm also happy with that. But anyway, there was this political thing of China virus, and then the Chinese started shooting back and saying, no, we think that you invented this in one of your labs in America, and that seems really crazy because how the hell could it get from a lab in America to Wuhan? And then both sides really stopped blaming each other, and both sides sort of went along with this WHO thing, which is being investigated. One of the chief investigators, Peter Duzak, is a guy who has already declared the case closed, more or less, and has a vested interest in the labs being vindicated because he's connected both with this lab and with gain-of-function research in general. So it's really not looking good. And as I've intimated in sort of 5 or 10 minutes, but one could really go on about it. If you look at the actual details of the virology, the argument that this wasn't made in a lab is it's there, but it's really standing up against a very strong argument that it was made in a lab. And people should be finding it out. People much smarter than me and who've spent their lives thinking about this should be openly debating it instead of sort of still relatively quiet thinking about it. But we're not there, in a sense, because America and China, Beijing and Washington, have a consensus that we shouldn't look into this too much. And there is America at its worst.
The Americans did, I believe, criticize the final WHO report. So I agree with the way that you have set up the Chimerica thing, but I think that there's a tension because some of America reinforces Chimerica and some of America fights against it at every turn. And the same thing.
So Trump's America was very anti-Chimerica. That's really what they headed. They said, stop exporting jobs. And then clever people said, no, those jobs are never going to come back because we'll just get machines to do them. But then some jobs did come back, or at least some jobs did increase, and sort of the income of the bottom 25% increased faster than the income of the top 25% for the first time in a while, because the top guys make their money by owning shares in companies that are using cheap Chinese sweat labor. That's one story. There's another set of stories coming from economists in the sort of Democratic camp. I'm not trying to pick apart one of those stories, but absolutely, you're dead right. The Trump's hard sell was, I'm going to break Chimerica. I would rather, if the choice is between Chimerica and Cold War II, neither of which are great options.
Cold War II.
I'm going to choose Cold War II. And you know, I mean, I really don't like either option myself. And I'm not trying to pick favorites between them. But I do think that if Chimerica is going to, I think it's fair to say it has obstructed the best path to really verifying the truth.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone can seriously and honestly claim that we've put our best effort into figuring out what really happened in a transparent and credible way. And as part of that, I think it's a kind of it's a lingering problem which is emblematic of broader problems which get into, you know, quite sophisticated technology issues, into the issues that concern me most, into currencies and sovereign bonds. But it's also into commodities, particularly, you know, the stuff that makes the world go round, energy stuff, whether it's solar or oil. I just feel like we need to be putting our best foot forward right now. And that when I say we as humans, that the greatest concentrations of wealth and power are presided over by Beijing and Washington. And that those two shouldn't be bringing out the worst in each other when they act together, and bringing out the worst in each other when they act in hostile conflict. And that seems to be more and more the pattern that we're sliding into. I don't know if that's alarmist, maybe not, but I struggle to think of the last time that Washington and Beijing got along in a way that I thought was really virtuous rather than kind of slimy. And I can't remember the last time that they fought where I thought, well, this is going to make things better.
Hmm. Well, we'll have to see.
It's a rough and hard place. Yeah.
This is definitely the conflict that's going to define at least the next 10 years, if not longer. But we are going very long now, so we must close. So, Gabriel, do you have a recommendation for people in short?
Don't F with cats. It's spelt F-U-C-K. It is a Netflix documentary about the worst demon of the esteem market that you can imagine. Someone who starts by killing cats to make YouTube videos and then gets even worse. And it's really well made, and it is at times very hard to watch, but I think they've done a good job of taking a very sinister subject and feeding it through the voice of people who have come out the other end. And in particular, people who just on the internet decided that they were going to make it their mission in their off hours to track this guy down and to stop him from killing. It's a brilliant.
Very much about the sort of, I wouldn't call that quite the dark belly of the internet, although it does cross into some of that territory. But it is the wild west of the internet. It's far from the civilized centers of, he's making
snuff YouTube movies. I think it's about as dark as you get. Yeah.
Well, I think you can get worse with sort of hiring hitmen and that kind of thing, and unregistered sites and terrorists and that sort of stuff. But yeah, this is really close to that awfulness. But also the sort of weird decentralized activism, which is I think the
quite
first
inspiring.
Proper example. Yeah, yeah, I think. The first proper example that I know of that was, I think, the 2009 protests against the Church of Scientology's taking down of a video on YouTube that was spearheaded by a group of people posting on the website 4chan. And that's a story for another day.
Yeah, but people can get this. It's not just up to Sherlock Holmes, you know. People can actually sit and listen and watch and read on the internet and actually figure things out that the police can't figure out, you know?
Yes. What can I recommend? I'm actually not sure at the moment what a good thing for me to recommend is. So I think I had an idea before the show, but I've completely forgotten it now. It's actually just looking through tabs I had saved recently on my browser to find out something. But I can't find anything, unfortunately. So let's call it to a close there. Thank you very much for listening, everyone. We know we went a bit long, and this may have been a bit technical in some places, but I think that it's still worth it because it's useful to know exactly why a theory is good or not, or how some of these things work. And so even if we're not all experts now, at least we have a vague understanding of what the debate is.
And I'm going to make a recommendation on Nicholas's behalf. If you want to read up about what we've been talking about so that you can see the words and see some links to start your own investigation, if you're inclined to, then just spend an hour or two thinking about this world-changing event. Nicholas Wade, Medium. The title of the piece is Origin of COVID, Following the Clues. There are a few really good pieces that I've read, but I think that this one sort of gets to the technical detail in a readable way the fastest. Some of the other ones kind of do the politics first, and I think you really want to get to just the case. So
it is a long read, though, so do settle in for it. It's not a 5-minute description. Cool.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone, and have a wonderful week, and we will see you soon, and keep the flag of liberty flying.